Highbridge Audio presents Prophets Pray, My 7-Year Investigation into Warren Jeffs and the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints by Sam Brower, narrated by Jonah Cummings. But others there are who, of necessity and by force, are driven to write history because they are concerned in the facts, and so cannot excuse themselves from committing them to writing for the advantage of posterity. Nay, there are not a few who are induced to draw their historical facts out of darkness into light, and to produce them for the benefit of the public, on account of the great importance of the facts themselves with which they have been concerned. Josephus. Preface. Warren Jeffs is a tall, bony man with a bulging Adam's apple and a frightening sense of his own perfection in the eyes of God. The self-proclaimed prophet of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, FLDS, now 55 years old, has taken more than 70 women and girls as wives, one of whom was just a few weeks past her 12th birthday, when he commanded her to lie in a ceremonial bed in the sanctum of his massive Texas temple and brutally raped her. He demands absolute, unquestioning obedience from his 10,000 followers. He has sodomized children as young as 5 years old, including his own nephew, who wrote a book about it. He and the FLDS are currently being investigated for defrauding the government of millions of dollars. He has destroyed untold hundreds of lives. Jeffs conducted his reign of terror with impunity for 3 decades thanks to a pervasive, mafia-like code of silence that he systematically instilled in the congregation. Then in the winter of 2004, a private investigator named Sam Brower began looking into the FLDS church, shocked by what he uncovered. Brower concluded that Warren Jeffs needed to be put behind bars post-haste. Thanks in large part to Brower's courageous efforts, in May 2006, Jeffs was placed on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list, was arrested 3 months later, and on September 25, 2007, was convicted of 2 counts of rape as an accomplice. His conviction has since been reversed on a technicality. But presently, Jeffs is incarcerated at Big Lake, Texas, awaiting trial on felony child abuse charges. For the better part of 5 years, I watched with awe and occasionally provided assistance as Brower relentlessly tracked Jeffs down, earned the trust of the prophet's victims, and provided state and federal law enforcement agencies with crucial evidence. A remarkable man on many levels, Sam Brower is the real deal. Listeners are apt to find his first-hand account of bringing Warren Jeffs to justice both extremely disturbing and absolutely riveting. John Krakauer, 2011. Chapter 1. Pray. November 30th, 2010. The prisoner's hands were cuffed to a belly chain that was cinched tight around his scrawny waist and secured by a padlock. The shackles on his ankles hobbled his stride to a shuffle as 2 large men, each gripping one of his arms, escorted him across the tarmac of Salt Lake International Airport toward an unmarked plane, clad in green and white prison stripes stenciled conspicuously with the letters UDC for Utah Department of Corrections, the man in custody appeared emaciated, frail, and disheveled. His guards wore Stetson hats, spit-shine cowboy boots, and freshly creased slacks. One of them had the distinctive badge of the Texas Rangers pinned to his chest. Snow was still banked along the side of the taxiway from a recent blizzard, and the air had a wintry bite. Noticing that the prisoner was shivering, Ranger Nick Hanna offered him a gray sweatshirt. As they proceeded toward the airplane, The man in cuffs bent over and tried to adjust his Coke bottle glasses, which had slipped down his nose. Ranger Hanna patiently helped him secure them, eliciting a meek, "Thank you." Hanna was struck by the man's unassuming voice. He had expected something much more commanding. An observer unfamiliar with the inmate's identity would have found it hard to believe that this was Warren Steed Jeffs, the notorious leader and self-proclaimed prophet of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, FLDS, the largest polygamous religious organization in North America. Hanna was under orders from Texas Governor Rick Perry to pick up Jeffs in Salt Lake City and transport him to the state of Texas to stand trial on charges of sexual assault of a child, aggravated sexual assault of a child under the age of 14, and bigamy, serious charges in any state, but which carry a life sentence in Texas. It was a place Jeffs had been desperately trying to avoid. I am a private detective. For the past 7 years, cases involving the FLDS Church and its pedophile prophet have consumed most of my waking hours. I live just outside of Cedar City, Utah, a stunning, high desert community of some 30,000 residents. Just beyond town, densely forested mountains capped with snow for much of the year rise 10,000 feet above sea level, overlooking a vast arid wilderness dotted with lonely buttes and red rock canyons. Even today, southern Utah remains a rugged landscape, and some regard it to be the middle of nowhere. But I find it to be quite accommodating, having moved here from Southern California as a young man, when I made the deliberate decision to raise my family in a smaller, safer environment. Cedar City is an awfully long way from the bright lights of New York or Los Angeles, both literally and metaphorically. But for me, it felt like the right place to be. As Ranger Hanna led Jeffs up the steps into the plane, he may have been wondering the same thing I did upon seeing Warren Jeffs in person for the first time. What is it about this man that would allow him to so completely dominate the lives of thousands of people? He didn't have the appearance of a maniacal prophet, didn't sound like one either. His droning voice and gangly appearance were more likely to bring to mind a nerdy middle school science teacher than an all-powerful tyrant. Usually brill-creamed into an immaculate pompadour, his black hair had been haphazardly chopped by a prison barber, giving him the look of a ridiculous comic book character. For weeks he had been force-fed through a tube, threaded through his nose and into his stomach, owing to his refusal to eat prison food. The lack of nutrition made him look pasty and alarmingly gaunt. Not one of his personal traits could be considered remotely charismatic. He is, nevertheless, a man who exudes an almost mystical power over his more than 10,000 FLDS followers, most of whom would do literally anything he commanded of them. An extremist offshoot of the traditional Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormon LDS Church, the FLDS was founded when its forebears broke away from the mainstream Mormons more than 100 years ago, after the latter officially renounced the practice of polygamy. Warren Jeffs' followers, who still regard so-called plural marriage to be the most holy and important doctrine ever revealed to man on earth, consider themselves to be the only true Latter-day Saints. They are zealous believers for whom absolutely nothing is more important than obedience to their religious tenets and priesthood leaders. In response to the many charges of child abuse that have been leveled against him in recent years by both civil and criminal courts in Utah and Arizona, Warren Jeffs defiantly announced to his followers that he would answer them nothing. Instead, in 2003, he went on the run, cowering in a network of safe houses he had set up throughout the country, trying to blend in with a world beyond the parochial confines of his church, a world he claimed to despise. As a private investigator, I always have cases cycling through my files, working through them fairly quickly, taking them as they come and then moving on. Never could I have anticipated, back in 2004, when I volunteered to help a family struggling to extricate themselves from the FLDS. I agreed to take on the case for a fee of $1 and had to lend them that dollar, that I was about to step into a curious and dangerous alternate universe hidden in plain sight, just a little more than an hour from my home. I couldn't believe that such a brutal cult could exist, virtually unnoticed in the United States in the 21st century. Through my efforts to help this one struggling FLDS family, I was unwittingly drawn into a desperate battle to bring Warren Jeffs to justice that has lasted, thus far, for more than 7 years. Over the course of those years, I discovered many of Warren Jeffs' most closely held secrets. Because I was a private investigator and had extensive knowledge of the FLDS culture and its leadership, I was asked by state and federal law enforcement agencies shortly after Warren Jeffs went on the lam and was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list to help to try to find him and put him behind bars. By taking on that initial FLDS case in 2004, I had unintentionally become the polygamy expert, an expression bestowed on me by people unfamiliar with the main focus of my investigations. In reality, I had become the expert on a paranoid theocracy run by a madman whose lust for power and compulsion to prey on children were his signature traits. Although polygamy is illegal in all 50 states, and more often than not leads to abuse in one form or another, it was not the focus of my investigation. That focus was child abuse, and my job had taken on a dual purpose, investigating civil grievances on behalf of my clients, and alerting a complacent bureaucracy to the sickening and illegal activities that had been taking place under all of our noses for so many years. One of my greatest challenges has been to locate and identify Jeff's extensive network of hideouts and determine who owns these properties. Despite an unsophisticated first impression conveyed by the 19th century attire favored by the church's faithful, FLDS accountants have become extremely adept at hiding assets through money laundering. Jeff's lieutenants are experts at establishing shell corporations to shelter property, equipment, and cash from the prying eyes of government auditors and corporate lenders. Lending institutions have been duped into financing loans worth millions of dollars, which the FLDS then allows to go into default, to the benefit of the church. Tracking down covert FLDS businesses is tedious work, but it has paid big dividends, including cracking bogus corporate facades established to secretly finance the Yearning for Zion Ranch, the massive religious stronghold constructed by Warren Jeffs in West Texas, as a place for his most devout followers to safely ride out the coming apocalypse. My dogged investigations into illegal FLDS affairs have led Jeffs and his followers to view me as a major irritant. While other law enforcement officers and private investigators who have attempted to penetrate the cult's formidable defenses have over time left the case, it has become increasingly clear to Warren Jeffs and the FLDS that I am not going away. On the afternoon that Jeffs arrived in Texas, under tight security, to stand trial, I was resting at home in Utah, recovering from recent open-heart surgery to correct the same kind of ailment that 1 month later would kill diplomat Richard Holbrook. It turned out to be an exceedingly complex 8-hour operation that I barely survived, and I couldn't help but think that had Warren Jeffs known about it, he would surely have taken credit for my near demise. Over the years, I have been the subject of many of his prayer circles, in which he would call upon God's whirlwind judgments to wipe me from the face of the earth for interfering in the activities of the Lord's faithful servants and the affairs of his church. I am hated by Jeffs, the police who act as his personal militia, and most of the church's membership, The more I lifted the veil of secrecy shrouding Jeffs and his cult, the more I came to fear that there was nothing that he was not capable of. My family wisely insisted that I take careful security precautions before going into surgery. Nobody but family and close friends was told that I was even sick, and I was admitted to the hospital in St. George, Utah, under an alias. Much to what I am sure would be Jeff's chagrin, had he been aware of it, I would go on to make a full and complete recovery. At times I felt a little silly over the precautions taken over my care in the hospital, but in the end I'm grateful that good sense prevailed in making sure that the FLDS did not have access to me while I was in a vulnerable state. About a week before the operation, I had visited the surgeon at his office in the hospital. As I crossed the parking lot and got into my car after the appointment, I was on the phone with my colleague Gary Ingalls, the only other investigator who is actively gathering evidence of criminal activity within the FLDS organization. Finishing the call, I glanced up at the passenger window and saw a camera pressed up against the glass. I flew out of the car, shouting a few choice expletives at the heavy-set person snapping photos of me in the privacy of my own vehicle. I became even more infuriated at what I saw. The man lurking behind the camera was none other than Willie Jessup, better known in southern Utah as Willie the Thug, the loudmouth FLDS spokesman, bodyguard, and church enforcer. Outraged, I ordered him to get his hands off my car and step back, or I would notify the police. As he backed away from my vehicle, he asked what I was doing in the hospital parking lot. "Oh, didn't I tell you?" I said. Willie got a screwy look on his face. "No, you didn't," he said. "I guess I must have thought it was none of your damn business then," I replied. I went on to let him know that this wasn't Short Creek, the hometown of the FLDS church and thousands of its members on the Utah-Arizona border, and in my estimation, the most lawless town in America. It was the real world where people could come and go without having to ask permission of their church leaders. Again, I warned him away from my car, and I whipped out my own camera and took photos of him as he lumbered away and climbed into a truck on the other side of the parking lot. My phone was still in my hand, and Gary had heard the entire exchange. The incident helped to remind me of the necessity of taking precautions to protect myself from any actions the FLDS might provoke. I had always considered an organized attack against me by FLDS goons unlikely, because such a move would draw attention to the cowardly men at the top of the organization who ordered the assault. I doubt Warren or his capos would want to face the legal consequences for such a crime. I am concerned, however, that some lone FLDS zealot might decide to take matters into his own hands. And the fact is, nothing would please Warren Jeffs and the FLDS hierarchy more than to see me dead. But I wasn't the only one making Jeffs' list of most hated enemies. There were many more whose demise he has prayed for, those who had found the courage to expose the crimes taking place within his secret society, as well as entire sections of the United States, which he deemed wicked enough to call down the judgments of God. Warren loved to travel the country under the pretext that God had commanded him to witness the gross wickedness of the world. He would ride with bodyguards and a favored wife or two in a small convoy, cursing and condemning the entire United States along the way. 6 months before Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Louisiana coast, God had sent Warren to New Orleans to report on the depravity on display at Mardi Gras, and to deliver the city over to the Lord for his great destruction. After taking in some of the parades in the French Quarter, and as many strip joints as he could cram into his 2 days on the town, the sanctimonious prophet raised his right arm to the square, as if swearing an oath in court, and prayed for the destruction of the entire city and its occupants, When Katrina later hit the Louisiana coast, Jeffs was quick to take credit for being the conduit that had brought death and destruction to thousands of people in the aftermath of the hurricane. It wasn't so much Warren's grandstanding that bothered me, but that his followers believe every word that proceeds forth from the mouth of the Lord's anointed, no matter how ludicrous. In the FLDS culture, Warren Jeffs is the anointed, and that kind of blind obedience, especially in an outlaw organization, can be a very dangerous thing. Most Americans only became aware of the FLDS in April 2008 when someone identifying herself as a teenage girl called authorities to say she was being sexually abused at the FLDS's 1,700-acre compound called the Yearning for Zion Ranch, located in West Texas, outside the small town of El Dorado. Texas authorities obtained a search warrant and served the ranch, but were unable to find the girl in question. What they found instead was shocking evidence of child abuse on a massive scale that had been kept hidden behind the strictly enforced FLDS code of silence. Believing they had no other choice, the authorities made the unprecedented and difficult decision to remove more than 460 children from the religious compound and make them wards of the state. Images of cops taking crying children from their distraught mothers were broadcast to riveted television audiences around the world. Those video clips portrayed only a tiny fraction of the real story. For instance, neither cameras nor reporters had been present to deliver the shocking blow-by-blow when innocent preteen girls were led by the hands of their mothers and fathers to a massive temple complex at the ranch and placed into a ritualistic sexual union with the prophet Warren Jeffs himself. Each girl, just another in his series of underage concubines. Nor were the cameras there when other young girls were handed over by Jeffs to one of his many cohorts to buy their loyalty and silence. Many in the press, diverted by the images of distraught mothers, entirely missed the larger outrages perpetrated by the FLDS, the abuse of little girls born and bred to satisfy the church priesthood's seemingly insatiable appetite for underage brides. The occurrence in Texas actually had its roots in the secluded FLDS town known as Short Creek, located in an isolated area along the Utah border known as the Arizona Strip. The church, under the direction of the prophet, owns and runs Short Creek and the lives of almost everyone in it from cradle to grave. Young girls are taken to the altar without even an elementary understanding of sex education or marital relationships with their new husband. Established families are arbitrarily broken up at the prophet's bidding, the man of the house kicked out of town, his children assigned another father, and the mothers ordered to take up intimate relations with other men. Unwanted young boys are literally discarded like trash along the highway in order to reduce competition for young brides. In Short Creek, education is mostly a means of indoctrinating children with religious dogma, and the FLDS enforces its dictates by controlling all town services, including the police force, which pays no heed whatsoever to the laws of man if those laws conflict with what the police consider to be the laws of God or religious edicts imposed by the self-proclaimed prophet. Religious zealots and bullies sort out dissenters and chase away strangers on a more unofficial and occasionally violent basis. Perhaps the most chilling example of how the prophet uses FLDS beliefs to control the community is found in the doctrine of blood atonement. Introduced by Brigham Young in the 1850s, but since disavowed by the mainstream Mormon church, this doctrine says that some sins are so heinous that there can be no redemption for those who commit them, not even redemption from Christ himself. The only way to obtain forgiveness for such a sin is for the transgressor to die, thereby spilling his own blood in atonement. Rulon Jeffs and his son Warren used the threat of this archaic rite for revenge and extortion against their own people. Who would disobey, when the prophet might declare that a disobedient act was forgivable only by death? And the influence of that prophet is large. While Short Creek is their base, FLDS leaders have thousands of followers in secret hideaways and safe houses that stretch from Canada to Mexico, all of whom consider it an honor to help the leaders hide from the law and carry out their prophetic commandments, legal or not. The YFZ Ranch in Texas is just one of scores of places of refuge, ranging in size from townhouses to huge compounds consisting of thousands of acres. Much has happened since the early days of my involvement, and my understanding of the culture has evolved considerably. My files now bulge with cases involving the FLDS and its practices, including rape, sodomy, extortion, child abuse, tax fraud, forced underage marriages, suicides, and kidnappings. It is, at its core, a very large, well-organized, and elaborately funded criminal enterprise. I found that hundreds of children make up a central part of the FLDS workforce for projects from routine residential carpentry to fulfilling sophisticated U.S. government contracts in clear violation of labor laws. As I gathered evidence and interviewed witnesses throughout the years, I was always looking for the biggest piece of the puzzle, the smoking gun, that seemed to be just beyond my grasp. Even when Warren Jeffs made the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list and was finally arrested on a lonely stretch of I-15 in Nevada, I still felt there was more to be discovered. Maintaining accurate records is encouraged in Mormonism, and I knew Jeffs had a compulsion for keeping an exhaustive accounting of his activities. In his case, it was also a matter of saving mementos of his reign as supreme leader, a trait he shared with despots throughout history. I knew that compulsion was his Achilles heel, and increasingly I was feeling a compulsion of my own to find the trophies that he was driven to preserve to prove his greatness to posterity. As it turned out, the smoking gun, along with frightening insights into the innermost thoughts, activities, and crimes of the Prophet of Doom, was there in Texas. Police discovered a cache of material carefully hidden in a sealed, secret vault beneath the temple grounds that consisted of Warren Jeffs' daily journals, the private priesthood record of President Warren Jeffs. The information they contained was beyond anything that any investigator could have ever imagined or hoped for. There were volumes of documents, marriage records, computer disks and hard drives, audio recordings and flash drives, along with thousands of pages dictated by the self-absorbed prophet, detailing his most deeply held beliefs, mad impulses, dreams, feelings, fears, and aspirations, often right down to the minute. The find was conclusive and graphic, validating conclusions I had come to over the course of my own investigation and shedding light on many unanswered questions. What made this man tick? Who was Warren Jeffs? What was his magic and what were his sins? Events and practices that had been assumed or guessed at could now be woven into a tapestry of facts dating back years. The darkest secrets and crimes within the FLDS were laid bare, exposing the who, what, when, where, why, and how of Warren Jeffs and his fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. At 11 a.m. on December 1, 2010, Jeffs was escorted by Ranger Hanna and a host of law enforcement personnel into a side entrance of the 51st District Court in San Angelo for his initial court appearance in Texas. He was still wearing the gray sweatshirt, but his stripes had been exchanged for bright orange jail pants. Judge Barbara Walther made Jeffs aware of his rights under the law and then asked him if he had an attorney, to which he replied, "I need more time." The judge then gave him a 120-day schedule in which she made it clear she intended to have all three charges against him tried and sentenced. Taken aback at the timetable, Jess refused to sign a document acknowledging that he had been made aware of the court's schedule. It appeared that he was again falling back on his answer-them-nothing approach to the criminal justice system. Still recovering from surgery and unable to witness the initial hearing, I felt an overwhelming sense of relief that Jeff's had finally made it to a Texas courtroom. For more than 4 years, he had been bounced around among jails and prisons in 4 states, and he had been convicted by a jury of his peers in Utah in 2007 for being an accomplice to rape. But in 2010, the Utah Supreme Court remanded his case back to the trial court based on a technicality, so that officially, Jeffs no longer had a conviction on his record. Although there are still ancillary charges pending against him back in Utah, and the feds still have fugitive charges waiting in the wings, the indictments in Texas are by far the most serious. He is accused of being the actual perpetrator who sexually assaulted preteen girls, not just an accomplice to rape as he was in Utah. Based on previous trials of FLDS members, it is likely that DNA evidence will be presented, as will admissions in Jeff's own words taken from his journal that will come into play as the magnitude of his crimes unfold in a Texas courtroom. I began my work on the FLDS cases, ferreting out the facts and evidence of Warren Jeff's atrocities barely a year after he named himself prophet and seized control of the church, its assets, and its thousands of followers. I have spoken to hundreds of victims and witnesses who allege crimes and abuses at Jeff's hands. Some of those victims were clients. Some just wanted someone to listen to them. And some became my friends. I have combed and read through and listened to thousands of hours of sermons and documents, including nearly 9,000 pages of Jeff's priesthood record, and I believe I have come to know the culture better than anyone not born into the group, and in some respects, perhaps even better than many who were. I know about the rampant child abuse that evolved into such an important part of the FLDS culture and caste system, and I know that the group will go to the greatest of lengths to protect their church leaders from having to answer for their crimes. On December 5, 2010, the Sunday after Warren took up residence at his new home in the Reagan County Jail in Big Lake, Texas, I was perched atop one of the Red Rock Bluffs overlooking Short Creek, my camera focused on the sprawling FLDS meeting house about a mile away in the distance below me. Judging by the number of vehicles packed into the parking lots and side streets adjacent to the building, the entire town seemed to be packed into its 4,000 seats. The streets were empty. And in the 3 hours I spent looking down from my vantage point, I saw only a handful of vehicles moving through town. I found the silence eerie and a bit unnerving, almost like the calm before the storm. I would later find out that Warren had been placing calls to the meeting house on Sundays from the jail's payphone. He had actually been patched into the sound system and was delivering sermons. This allowed him to maintain control over his flock from the Texas jail. Lately, though, those sermons were taking on a more ominous tone. Back in his element at the pulpit, Warren's voice took on the hypnotic tenor so familiar to his followers as he revealed an event of impending doom. "Very, very soon," the prophet intoned, "two meteors will strike the earth, resulting in a firestorm in which the wicked would be destroyed and the righteous would be lifted up and spared God's whirlwind judgments." He prophesied that the lost 10 tribes of Israel would once again be reunited as foretold, and God would deliver his prophet from prison and punish all those who had persecuted his chosen people. As absurd as it sounds, thousands of people believe those bizarre predictions with every ounce of their soul, simply because Jeff says it is so. I've come to the conclusion that the only chance to eliminate child abuse within the FLDS is if the church membership can be awakened to the fact that the man they call prophet is a criminal and a fraud. but because they have been subjected to generations of mind control and subservience, I no longer believe that they have the ability to come to that conclusion independently. Realistically, the best that can be hoped for is that Jeffs will be held accountable for his crimes by spending the remainder of his life in a Texas prison, perhaps with some time and distance between Warren and his dutiful followers. The latter will begin to develop the ability to think for themselves and make decisions on their own, without having to first seek counsel from their religious leaders. For the time being, Warren Jeffs is awaiting trial in a Texas prison. I still find it astounding that although he has been incarcerated in various locations in Utah, Arizona, Nevada, and Texas for the past 4 years, he has no conviction for any crime on his record. So, for many reasons, I will most definitely be in Texas to observe Warren's trial, and I hope that thousands of his followers and hundreds in the news media will be there to witness it as well. As one of my colleagues in Texas who is close to the case succinctly put it, it's time that it all comes out. Chapter 2. Ross. It began for me on a winter morning in the middle of January 2004, as I skimmed through the newspaper before heading to my office. An overnight storm had crashed through the area. The air in Cedar City would be clean and refreshing. Then a picture on the front page caught my eye, and I paused to read the story while munching a donut and sipping a can of V8 juice. Everyone in our area was aware of the ongoing saga of the FLDS down in Short Creek and of its strange leader, the self-proclaimed prophet Warren Jeffs. News coverage of the secretive Jeffs and his flock was usually sparse, but it had taken on a magnetic soap opera flavor after the prophet carried out an internal political bloodletting on January 10 by banishing 21 men from the sect in one swoop and reassigning all of their wives and children to other men. The shakeup caused anxious authorities in the surrounding areas to offer assistance to the Short Creek police in case there was a riot. Jeffs sniffed at such attention by the law and the media because he considered the actions he took with his large and obedient congregation to be a private matter, what he called setting the people in order. Now he apparently was at it again, wreaking havoc on yet another family, but this time with a surprising result. The front page photo was of a man by the name of Ross Chatwin, who was holding high a copy of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, William L. Shirer's account of Nazi Germany. I had read that book when I was a kid, and had been fascinated at how an entire nation had lost its collective mind and followed a madman like Hitler into utter destruction. Chatwin was claiming the same despotic phenomenon was occurring in Short Creek with Jeffs, who in turn was charging that Chatwin had been booted out of the church because he was a master deceiver. This time, the expelled member of the obedient flock had said, "No, I'm not going," after being commanded to leave his home, family, and community. It was an act of defiance that just didn't happen within obedient FLDS culture. That was when my curiosity got the best of me. Short Creek was only a little more than an hour southwest of my home. I decided to drive down and see if I could meet this unusual man who was standing up against the prophet, seer, and revelator of this strange religion. Short Creek is actually two towns in two different states, although they operate in most ways as a singular entity. On one side of the border, it is Colorado City, Arizona, while literally on the other side of Uzona Street, it is Hilldale, Utah. Local residents just call the community the Crick. No one bothered me when I rolled into town. Something I would soon discover was unusual, and I found the address of the Chatwin simply by walking into the town clerk's office and asking. The receptionist apparently was so shocked at fielding a question from a tall stranger wearing sunglasses and cowboy boots that she just blurted out the directions to 245 North Willow. Within a few minutes, I was sitting in my car before a clutter of lumber and drywall at a small home that was still a work in progress. My impulsive decision was bothering me. Was I doing the right thing by intruding unannounced on a besieged family in a time of crisis? I was almost ready to turn around and leave when a man stepped outside, the guy in the picture. His sudden, friendly greeting caught me off balance.
"Hey, how you doing?"
he called out. He was of medium build, with a round, pleasant face and neat brown hair. The discount store sneakers, slacks, and long-sleeved shirt buttoned at the wrist and collar stamped him as FLDS. Almost everyone around Short Creek, more than 10,000 souls, belongs to or has been discarded by that one church, the only one in town. Everyone else in the world is referred to as a Gentile, and Gentiles, who seldom convert to rigid fundamentalist beliefs, are not welcome in their insular community. The children of Short Creek are taught to fear them and their world. I gave a wave, smiled, and eased open the door of my four-wheel drive, climbing out with care to show that I had nothing to hide and was no threat. I am quiet by nature, but a pretty big guy, and my size and appearance can be a helpful psychological deterrent to potential problems. I stand close to 6'4" in my boots, weigh about 225 pounds, and appear even bigger in the cold months when I wear a cowboy hat and a heavy jacket over bulky winter clothes. I have a mustache and at times chin hair. My eyes have a natural squint from working long hours beneath the harsh western sky. "I'm looking for Ross Chatwin," I said.
"Well, that's me,"
the man replied, his gentle voice betraying not even a quiver of nervousness. Chatwin had been openly disgraced, excommunicated from his church, and deprived of his livelihood, and he was under direct orders from the prophet to leave his home, his wife, and his children. He was shunned by local businesses, had been abandoned by lifelong friends, and was being watched by the town marshals. In his own mind, he had done nothing wrong. Everyone, especially God, was still his friend. Few in Short Creek agreed. "Mr. Chatwin, my name is Sam Brower, and I'm a private investigator. I think I might be able to help you." It was a pretty vague reason for a big guy he had never seen before to suddenly appear in his driveway. Chatwin had been expecting some other visitors, thugs from the God Squad. The church controlled local law, and possibly a few unofficial enforcers who might be coming by to make him leave town. He gave me a welcoming nod.
"Well then, come on in."
So I did. And by crossing that threshold, I set a new course for my life. While construction of the house was underway, the Chatwin family was living in the unfinished basement, a chilly place with ribs of bare studs exposed against the gray cement walls. Once downstairs, Ross introduced me to his wife, Lori, a soft-spoken woman wearing a light blue blouse and a long skirt, with her wavy hair pulled back and braided. Their five energetic children tumbled about. Ross was eager to talk, even to a sympathetic stranger, and he opened up as soon as we settled around an old plastic laminate kitchen table. He was 35 years old and had only about an eighth-grade education, which was not unusual in Short Creek. I would eventually discover that most boys were pulled out of school at about that age to work on construction sites. But even while in the classroom, their private school curriculum was more focused on the history of the FLDS and an individual member's duties to the church and its leaders than it was on reading, writing, or arithmetic. The townsfolk had turned openly hostile toward the Chatwins, and Ross was selling used cars and working as a mechanic whenever he could rustle up work to support his family. The couple had been married for about 12 years and had remained monogamous, an unfortunate distinction in this fertile homeland of polygamy. I understood that almost everyone in the town was a zealous participant in what they politely called plural marriages. Even as FLDS members smoothly lie to outsiders that there is no polygamy, multiple marriages are the norm, and there has always been a steady trafficking in underage girls bound for the altar. Ross Chatwin was not a polygamist, but he wanted to be one. That, I found, was the real reason he was in trouble. Until recently, things had been looking up for the Chatwins, as evidenced by their having been blessed with this unfinished home. The church owns all the property in Short Creek through its financial operation, the United Effort Plan Trust, UEP. One of Ross's brothers, as a reward for his faithfulness, originally had been given the little piece of land on which to build a house. When the brother turned against the church and left town, the church leaders reassigned the property to Ross. Prior to that, Ross and Lori had been living with their kids in something that was little more than a dugout house with a roof. Delighted with their new lodgings, the Chatwins figured the time had come to bring a new addition into their family, a young girl who would be another bride for Ross and a sister wife to Lori. That, however, was not their decision to make. Only the prophet had the authority to decide who married whom, so by pursuing the matter on their own, they were treading on dangerous turf and teetering on the brink of heresy. The 48-year-old prophet, at the pinnacle of the FLDS hierarchy, could and did marry at will, and he had a large harem of his own at that time, estimated at about 50 ladies, a number that was growing fast. But for someone like Ross, near the bottom of the church pecking order, that option just did not exist, and he and Lori were concerned that busy and beleaguered Uncle Warren might never get around to assigning them a new wife. The most senior leaders of the FLDS are sometimes referred to as Uncle by other church members. The honorary title is meant as a show of respect and endearment, even if the man it refers to is evil to his core. So the Chatwins began an almost antique flirtation with a 16-year-old girl, passing notes back and forth like moonstruck kids in a high school study hall. Lori kept the letters in a small cardboard box and allowed me to look through them. None contained any mention of passion or sex. Most were just innocent, "I love you, do you love me?" notes. The girl they were courting suffered from severe health problems and was probably wondering about her own prospects of marriage. To the delight of the Chatwins, their prospective bride thought that marrying them was such a good idea that she suggested including one of her girlfriends. That could mean a multiple plural ceremony. The Chatwins had foolishly hoped to spin the arrangement in a manner acceptable to the prophet, who, more than anyone, they believed, should understand how God requires a husband to have numerous wives while on earth in order to ascend to higher positions in the celestial hereafter. They could hardly have made a bigger mistake, and at exactly the wrong time. Only a few weeks earlier, Warren had successfully crushed troublesome opponents to his reign with the mass expulsion of 21 men and taken away their homes and families. Even before the dust had settled, this new challenge of an unauthorized bride had arisen seemingly out of nowhere. The manic Jeffs concluded that Ross was part of a wider conspiracy to topple him from power. So the prophet announced that satanic influences were being spread among his people and then excommunicated Ross. Ross was instructed to write out a complete list of his sins, which Jeffs would compare to a true list of transgressions that had been divinely revealed to him by God. It was an exam no one could pass. "My list of sins obviously did not match up with the list of sins that Uncle Warren put together," Ross told me with a rueful grin. On Wednesday, January 14th,
FLDS stooge and UEP trustee James Zitting drove out to the Chatwin place and delivered the final verdict. Ross was out. The order was crushing. He was no longer welcome anywhere in Short Creek and must leave his home immediately. Lori was to drop him, and even a goodbye kiss might jeopardize her own salvation. She and the children were to be reassigned. There would be no divorce, no custody hearing, and no due process of law. Just the absolute command by the prophet to leave his family and home and repent from a distance. He was not to write or call or try to make contact with the family in any way, but was required to continue paying tithes and offerings to the church. The girl the Chatwins had been courting would soon be married off to someone else. James Zitting growled that he had come over just to deliver the ultimatum, not to listen to any explanations from the Chatwins. Ross replied that he fully understood.
"Good," Zitting said. "So let's get doing it."
He left, believing his mission had been accomplished. I would later discover that Zitting had had a special reason for being forceful that day. He had recently been cautioned by the prophet to shape up. Fail in this task, and he might be the next one gone. The word spread swiftly throughout Short Creek, not only that Ross had been excommunicated, but also that he and Lori were refusing to knuckle under. Lori was a most unusual FLDS wife. Although trained from childhood to be subservient and obedient, to keep sweet no matter what, she had a rather independent personality. She could be outspoken and assertive, and her words carried weight with her husband. "I love him, not Warren," she told a reporter. She would stick with Ross. There was a small number of other so-called apostates in town who had gone or were going through the same painful process of excommunication, but who had not left the area because it was the only home they had ever known. The outside world was petrifying and foreign to them. The Chatwins would be joining this subculture of the dispossessed. Ross explained to me what had happened next. Poverty-stricken and incredibly naive, he had found an envelope containing some $220 on his doorstep over the weekend. Also in the envelope was a handwritten note asking Chatwin to mail copies of an enclosed letter to FLDS members who were still faithful to the prophet. He could keep any change left over from the costs of copying, envelopes, and mailing. "I guess whoever left the note knew I needed the money," Chatwin later told a reporter. So Lori and Ross had sat down and addressed envelopes to about 500 people, and then he mailed the letters. The text of the letter claimed that Uncle Rulon Jeffs, the late father of Warren, had appeared in a revelation to an unnamed dissident and announced that Warren was not the prophet after all. This bombshell of a letter claimed that an older man named Lewis Barlow should be in the top position. Barlow was one of those who had been excommunicated in Warren's abrupt cleansing of the church. Warren Jeffs is remarkably adept at monitoring and micromanaging almost every person, business, shop, gas station, and home in Short Creek. And it did not take long for news to get back to the prophet that Ross Chatwin was spreading unauthorized visions about who the true leader of the FLDS was. Ross was not yet finished, for in this unprepossessing man, the apostates had found a spokesman with nothing to lose and a lot to say. They pitched in to help him stage a front porch press conference on January 23rd. During which he stood before news microphones and charged, "This Hitler-like dictator has got to be stopped before he ruins us all and this beautiful town." He also accused Uncle Warren of recklessly wasting more than $100 million of UEP assets, a portion of which was being squandered on building a secret new compound, a hidden place known within the FLDS only as Zion. Very few of the rank-and-file membership knew it even existed, let alone where it was. "We need your help to stop Warren Jeffs from destroying families, kicking us out of our homes, and marrying our children into some kind of political brownie point system." It had been that open plea that had piqued my interest. Was the prophet truly running a whole town in modern-day America by using these despotic techniques? It seemed impossible to me. During the 3 hours that I listened to Ross and Lori, I stayed in professional mode and carefully sifted through their words. Were they lying? Were they vague or inconsistent on important details? Were they just after money or media attention? Did the timeline hang together? Was there any proof? They had lent me their love letters to the girl, allowed me to copy the entire hard drive of their computer, and answered all of my questions without hesitation. Those were not the actions of people trying to hide information. I started to believe them. I finally had to halt their astonishing narrative to explain a sticking point, one they seemed not to fully comprehend. In addition to polygamy being illegal, the girl they wanted to marry was only 16. That would be illegal on its own, regardless of any equally illegal polygamous relationship, and Ross could have been prosecuted not only for bigamy, but for child abuse as well. It was strange having to explain to a couple of adults that there was a huge, sprawling nation beyond the boundaries of Short Creek and that, like it or not, they were part of the state of Arizona and the United States of America, and subject to the laws of the land. Living in their little theocracy had blinded them to the values and laws of our society. "So, you understand that the legal age for marriage is 18, I finally said, raising my eyebrows to elicit a promise. "Right, Ross?" Ross said nothing. Lori remained silent. 18. Right, Ross? Stronger this time. It was a deal-breaker for me. There was a soft groan of acceptance as he mentally discarded an important card from his life. Okay, right. 18. It was time for me to make a decision. I had found no inconsistencies in their story, but to work on their situation as a private investigator, I had to be paid for my services in order to invoke the protection of client confidentiality, the same as with a doctor or a lawyer. "I think I can help you, Ross, but first you have to officially hire me." "I don't have any money," he said. "Just give me a dollar," I said. "That's enough." "Okay, but I don't have a dollar." I pulled out my wallet, removed a $1 bill, and slid it across that laminate table. Ross put his finger on it and slid it back. Transaction complete. I was on the job. Chapter 3. Uncle Warren. That initial meeting with Ross and Lori Chatwin left me trying to sort out a host of questions, with only a minimum of information. I had the nagging feeling, common among private detectives, that the case needed to be made stronger. After a lot of consideration, I made myself a promise. If I found one single thing screwy with Ross's story, I was gone. One thing that bothered me was that I had known some FLDS people for years, and they in no way resembled those who were perpetrating this outrage against the Chatwins down in Short Creek. I could not imagine them wanting to rip a family apart and throw them out of their home in the middle of winter. In my construction days, out there building houses on scalding hot concrete pads, I had become friends with a number of FLDS men. Although, at times, their social skills left room for improvement, they excelled in construction. Most were hard-working, decent guys. They were polite and wore clean jeans, with their women in modest prairie dresses, and the small kids scrubbed squeaky clean. They kept to themselves, worked hard, did not bother others, and lived far away. Under those tame circumstances, their practice of polygamy was generally viewed as a minor annoyance. I assumed that grown women were making a conscious decision to marry a man who had other adult wives, all living according to the precepts of their shared faith. Weird, but not really a big deal. Some religions play with rattlesnakes. The FLDS had been around the area for so long that they were accepted as just another part of the scenery. Those people, my friends, didn't seem to be a bunch of religious lunatics. Still, facts were facts. The FLDS church leaders indeed were heartlessly trying to dump the Chatwins out into the cold. My personal scale of justice had tipped in favor of Ross and Lori because of the evidence and their frankness, but perhaps that was just because the other dish on the scale was empty. After years in the area, I realized I didn't know much at all about this religion and its practices. I wanted to know more. Who was Warren Jeffs? What was the FLDS? And why were they doing this? Figuring out who was who in that zoo would have to wait. I had the more immediate concern of trying to keep the Chatwins in their home down in Short Creek. I put Ross in touch with the Mojave County Attorney's Office in Arizona, which steered him to a legal clinic in Kingman that provides assistance to those who cannot afford to pay for a lawyer. The hardship eviction case was then assigned by the Arizona Community Legal Services to a lawyer named Joan Dudley. I couldn't have planned it better if I had tried. Joan embodied many things that the FLDS despised about the outside world. It was well known that in FLDS schools, teachers trimmed pictures of people of color out of the textbooks. Joan was African American. In the FLDS, women are always subservient. Joan was in-your-face aggressive. Women were not to be highly educated. Joan was smart as a whip. I knew she was unafraid of any legal nonsense by the United Effort Plan attorneys or the FLDS and would not back down an inch in the coming fight. She actually seemed to be looking forward to it. While she took charge of the legal side, I went back to Short Creek because Ross was telling me that he and Lori were afraid to set foot outside their house. Apparently, the church was just waiting to pounce and move his brother, Stephen, into the unfinished upstairs portion. In my world, that made no sense. Although the church's UEP Trust had issued an eviction order, the unsettled civil case was in dispute and headed for court. Joan Dudley, active as an officer of the court, wrote a "To Whom It May Concern" letter that spelled out that the property was in dispute and no action could take place involving the Chatwins' home until the matter was ruled on by a judge. Stephen had no claim whatsoever on the property, which made the threat to move him into the house seem absurd. Still, Ross had grown up in Short Creek and knew the way things worked there. I was willing to take his word for it, and in part to help them feel a little safer. I went back down with construction tools to help him finish off the basement living quarters, install new locks, cut an access to the upstairs area, and build a stairway that would finally connect the two parts and make the place a single, livable house. I began to understand why the Chatwins were scared. No longer was the mean, sharp edge of the FLDS hidden to me. I had lived for years right up the road, only an hour away, and was in the law enforcement business not only as a private investigator, but as a bail bondsman and a bounty hunter. But like most residents of Utah and Arizona, I had paid little attention to goings-on in obscure Little Short Creek. The FLDS and its members might as well have been a community of invisible ghosts. Now the town was turning ugly right before my eyes. As I had started paying attention to them, they had also figured out who I was. When I rolled into town this time, a convoy of overgrown pickup trucks with menacing dark-tinted windows roared into my rearview mirror. Then they were right on my tail, gnawing at my bumper, apparently trying to force me off the road. They cut around, boxed me in, slowed down, then sped up and sprayed gravel from their big tires. The tiny rocks peppered my car like bits of shrapnel. It was like being the main character in a Twilight Zone episode, the unaware stranger who has just driven off the map into a strange parallel dimension known as Short Creek. Being alone in a situation that had turned unexpected